Welcome to the Space Show, Tegan.
Thanks, Andrew. I'm very happy to be here today.
Now, two scientists we could talk about, one everyone's heard of, and one that many, if not most people, will recognise. Who are they?
So today, this discovery that I'm going to be talking about really centres the theories of Albert Einstein and Stephen Hawking.
And what did Albert Einstein do with this?
Lots of things, but the main thing that is relevant for today is that Einstein came up with the theory of general relativity, which tells us all about how gravity and space-time behave. And in particular, this theory predicts these things called gravitational waves. Now, gravitational waves can be generated when very dense objects like black holes merge together in the universe. And then we have Stephen Hawking, whose theories about black hole behavior complement and are consequential from Einstein's theory of general relativity. So Hawking came up with this idea of black hole thermodynamics, and in particular the black hole area law, which says that the area of a black hole encodes its entropy, and since entropy in the universe can only ever increase, the entropy of black holes and then their area can also only increase.
Perhaps you could tell us a bit about entropy.
Absolutely. Entropy is a fascinating law of physics, which says that, so entropy is a measurement of kind of the disorder or chaos in the universe. And the laws of physics say that entropy can only ever increase across time and never decrease. So kind of like this idea that, you know, if you build a sandcastle, it'll eventually get washed away and you won't randomly build a sandcastle again.
I used to sometimes say it's the law of the bedroom, that things get less and less organized if you just leave them alone.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Entropy is like a teenager's bedroom out in the universe.
Okay. And what was Hawking's contribution?
So Hawking took this idea of general relativity, black holes and gravitational waves, and the idea of thermodynamics and entropy, and tried to piece them together because, you know, black holes are these very dense regions of space-time where not even light can escape. So it's not very clear how they could follow the laws of thermodynamics. But of course they should, because they're objects in the universe. And so Hawking came up with this black hole area theorem and realized that the surface area of the black hole is the thing that encodes the entropy of the black hole. And so that's how we're able to make black holes also follow the laws of entropy.
At the time he did that, the black holes weren't firmly established, were they? They're just in the process of being actually discovered, as against predicted.
That's right. So this was back in 1970, and black holes were an relatively accepted theory of physics, but they hadn't been directly observed yet, so they hadn't been completely verified at that stage.
So I believe, what, Cygnus X1 was the first one?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I think so.
Okay. So a black hole is where a star has collapsed down to zero size. But how can something of zero size have an area?
Yeah, so it's quite an interesting one. So you're completely correct. It's a star that has been unable to sustain its own gravity anymore, so it's collapsed down into what we call a singularity, so a point of absolutely zero size. So when we talk about the area of the black hole, we're actually talking about this thing called the event horizon, and that is the region around the singularity where not even light can escape from that region. So you know, something, light will come to the black hole, but once it goes past this event horizon, it can't get back out. And so this is sort of the black part of the black hole and what we're talking about when we talk about the area.
So if I stand on Earth and shine a torch up, that light escapes into space. If I'm outside the event horizon and I shine the torch away, the light will escape. But if I'm inside the event horizon and I shine my torch out, what happens?
So if you're inside the event horizon and you're trying to shine a light towards the outside, the light will just never be able to reach that boundary. So for an observer outside, we'll just see absolutely nothing. We won't know that you're doing that at all.
Now, it's using gravitational waves since, 2015, we've been able to detect black hole mergers. And what's new about what you've discovered?
Yeah, so we've just passed the 10th anniversary of the very first gravitational waves from black hole mergers, actually, which was very, very exciting. This particular discovery, which we made in January of 2025, was the loudest and clearest signal that we've ever seen from two black holes merging in gravitational waves.
And how did you find out about this?
So this discovery was made by the LIGO-Virgo-Kagra collaboration, and I'm a member of this collaboration. And I was sort of on shift to analyze the data that was coming in for that week when this particular event arrived. It was measured in the two LIGO detectors in the US and arrived as a measurement of the degree of change in space-time that the gravitational waves made as the black holes merged.
So what did you see? Did you hear it, or did you get a computer printout? What happens?
Yeah, so we do often talk about gravitational waves as a sound, and that's because the frequency of the gravitational wave signal that we receive actually translates into an audible frequency for humans. So it's really nice for demonstrating how gravitational waves actually kind of evolve in a audible format. The data that we actually measured was what we call the strain. So that's the amount of squeezing and stretching of space-time that the gravitational waves have caused that we are able to measure here on Earth with the LIGO observatories. And so the way that filtered over to the analysts like me was essentially a data product of the a measurement of that strain as a function of time. And so really we see it as more of a wiggly line that we're then able to do things like convert into sound or analyze that data to understand the physics of that particular gravitational wave.
We spoke with Professor Thrain last week, and he explained that these things are so far away we can't actually see them physically with optical means, just the gravity. But from that, you can work out various things about the black hole itself. What are they?
Absolutely. So, yeah, not only are black holes black, so very difficult to see, but they're so far away that we wouldn't be able to observe the galaxy that these black holes came from, for example. And so, yeah, gravitational waves are one of the only ways for us to directly observe black holes in the universe. And so from this signal, we're able to identify the masses of the black holes, which in this case, it was two black holes that were each around 30 times as massive as the sun. We're able to discern whether they're spinning, how far away they are, and as well as details, the angle of that system in relation to Earth and things like that. So we're able to really unpick a lot of information from this gravitational wave signal.
How on earth do you tell the mass, for example, when you can't see it?
Yeah, so, all we've got is this measurement of the gravitational wave strain or gravitational wave length change that they made. And so we need to use sort of complicated computer modeling to actually take that and untangle all of the parameters. And so that's actually one of the main parts of my PhD has been, you know, the methods with which we get a gravitational wave signal and then come up and measure what the masses, spins and distance of them are.
And what about temperature?
Yes.
Given that normally you put a thermometer in something or you use a pyrometer to measure the radiant energy, since nothing's coming out of the black hole, how on earth can you measure the temperature?
Temperature is a super interesting one. And we don't necessarily directly measure the temperature in this case, but instead we infer what the temperature would be based on the masses that we've measured. So, which is a direct consequence, coming back to Hawking, of Stephen Hawking's theories of black hole thermodynamics.
And how do you tell the surface area of the event horizon?
Yeah, so the surface area of an event horizon of a black hole, if black holes are indeed governed by general relativity, then the surface area of the black hole should be decided by the mass and the degree of spin of that black hole.
So you've been able to show that when two black holes merge, the area increases and doesn't get smaller.
Yeah, that's right. So what we actually did was we measured the area of the black holes when they were far apart before they merged, and then we waited for the merger to happen and for the new larger black hole to settle down into its rest state. And then we measured the area of that black hole. And what we found is that the area of the final black hole was bigger than the area of the two initial black holes put together. And we made that measurement to the highest confidence that we've ever been able to until now.
And has anyone done this before?
This kind of methodology had been done before with the very first gravitational wave merger, 1509-14, which happened 10 years ago. And that particular event also hinted at the fact that Hawking was right, but the measurement was not able to be made at near the precision that we have here just because of the signal not being as clear 10 years ago as we were able to get it now.
Uh-huh. So your results being published?
Yes, they were published on Thursday in Physical Review Letters.
Which is a major scientific publication?
Yes, that's right. And it's also open access, so anyone can have a look at the paper if they like.
Okay. Anything else you want to tell us about?
Just that, you know, this was a very exciting result, and I think one of the most exciting things was the collaborative nature of it. So this, you know, the result came from a global collaboration, and in particular lots of Australians actually worked on making this discovery. So I think that's been really exciting and really great for Australian gravitational wave science.
And what's your status now? Are you a PhD student?
So I've actually just submitted my PhD thesis. So right now I'm actually in that kind of limbo between submitting and starting my next job. But as of now, I'm technically still a student, yeah.
And where would you hope your career goes from here?
Well, I'm very excited to have a postdoctoral research job lined up to start later in the year over in the US at Princeton. Where I'm going to keep using gravitational wave signals to understand the physics of black holes and neutron stars.
And that's one of the centres where they do a lot of that research, isn't it?
Yeah, so Princeton has been really huge for the theory of black hole behaviour. And, of course, Einstein lived in Princeton for sort of the last years of his life. And so, yeah, it's a huge place for this kind of thing.
So our conversation starts with Einstein and finishes with Einstein.
As with all things, yeah.
Well, thanks, Tegan, for joining us on The Space Show.
Thank you so much.